maybe an inch of accumulation. Today's high 22 with winds up to 20 miles per hour. So we started the morning in single digits. Now we're in double digits. 11 in Kenosha, 13 in Racine. Windy. Wind south at 14, gusty to 28, wind chill minus 13. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have three interviews for you today, one that is newly recorded, and then two interviews from the Morning Show archives that we hope you will find interesting and enjoyable. Here's part one. Over the course of a typical calendar year, I am probably pitched dozens, if not hundreds, of self-help books. They are everywhere. They continue to proliferate. And some seem to be quite worthwhile, and others not so much. And one of the challenges in hosting the morning show is for me to try and choose those self-help books which I think might indeed be authentically helpful to a large number of morning show listeners. And of course, there's no way to know absolutely for certain. But I am pretty confident that many of you will find something helpful in a very intriguing new self-help book, which is actually only an audiobook from Alexis Fernandez Preixa. The book is called How to Chase Change, 30 Days to Master Your Mindset. This is an audiobook in which Alexis Fernandez Preixa sets out 30 small concepts, each one 10 minutes at a time. So the book is designed to be listened to a day at a time, 10 minutes at a time, and takes one through an intriguing journey of, if you will, self-discovery and of greater understanding of oneself and how you are seeing the world and moving through the world and exploring important concepts like turning goals into action, increasing your self-confidence, overcoming disappointments or even heartbreak, and committing to small changes that can ultimately make a great difference in your life. Alexis Fernandez Preixa actually was an aspiring actress for a time, but kept finding her interest pulled back to the field of neuroscience and ultimately neuroanatomy. And it is that expertise which she also brings to her very popular podcast. I cannot say the name of this podcast in its entirety because of its language, and it is indeed a very explicit podcast in terms of language. But Alexis Fernandez Preixa, in her podcast called Do You Blankety Blank Mind, shares a great deal of interesting and insightful information about the way in which we can find a greater sense of meaning and purpose in our lives. And again, her latest book, How to Chase Change, 30 Days to Master Your Mindset, is an audiobook from Simon & Schuster. I wanted to get one rather mundane question out of the way at the outset, which is that your new book, How to Chase Change, 30 Days to Master Your Mindset, is at least at this moment only an audiobook. Was that a choice of yours? I mean, is there a way in which that is a format in which you feel more comfortable, maybe because of your experience as a podcaster, or at some point will we perhaps also see this book in print?
I think we might see the book in print in the future, but I think I wanted to start doing audio only because, well, you're right, I'm used to the format of podcasting. But because the way the book is structured, I want people to consume one chapter a day for 30 days. It's 10 minutes. And because it's 10 minutes of audio, I think it is just so easy to consume 10 minutes of audio. It's almost impossible not to do it. I wanted the barrier of entry to be very low, that everyone could access it when you're on your morning walk, while you're, you know, tidying up the house. You can just have that playing while you're doing something else. I think way more people can commit to listening to 10 minutes of audio a day to make this change instead of sitting down and reading through the pages. So I thought that this would be just a great way to, you know, reduce the excuses to not do it.
That makes all the sense in the world. And you do offer up 30 different concepts over the course of 30 days. I'm curious about the order in which we hear these and the order in which you have laid them out. How much of a challenge was that for you to not only come up with these 30 important concepts, but to string them together in what made the most sense to you as a logical and helpful order?
There was a bit of back and forth while I was actually creating it. What helps is I packaged them into five different modules as well. So module one goes for roughly 5 days and then it moves on to the next module. And that way it was a lot easier to decide on kind of the order, because the first module talks about, you know, your identity and who you are up until today and your beliefs around your abilities and yourself, and kind of doing a bit of an inventory of taking what works, you know, discarding what no longer serves you. Then we move into relationships, you know, the biggest one being with yourself, but also other relationships in your life, because what we allow from relationships really determine how we continue to treat ourselves and, you know, how we set boundaries. And then you move on to, you know, habits and goal setting and things like that. So I tried to think of how can you set the foundation in order to then layer on the next topic. And that's kind of how I decided to order it and structure the book.
One of the things that I especially appreciate is the way in which you take aim at some very careless assumptions that get made. And I think among the most significant is the assumption that so often gets made about limitations and the concept of limitations. And so often, and particularly in self-help books, we often read or hear that that the sky's the limit, anything is possible, you just have to dream, and so on. And I mean, we're told that in Disney movies and all kinds of other sources of inspiration and information. And you were telling us in How to Chase Change to not be afraid to not only think about our own limitations, but to embrace them and learn from them. What do most people miss about the importance of understanding our own limitations and accepting them?
Yeah, well, there's so many things that are limiting factors in our life. And one of the main things is the things that are not within our control. You know, we could have all these ideas that we, you know, for our future and for what we want, but so many things are just simply not directly within our control. And when you can own that, and when you can acknowledge what is within your control, which is then not, you can push past aspects of that limitation, and what's not within your control, then I feel like there's so much more that you can do. So I'll give you an example with my life. Before neuroscience, I really wanted to be an actress. I did everything I could. I worked so hard for it, and it just wasn't happening for me. And if I had set my sights on, you know, no plan B, this is it, then who knows how long I would have been trying to slog it out and not make it in that industry, because for whatever reason, it just wasn't clicking for me. But instead, I was able to discover a new passion, pivot, find something that I love even more, but at the same time still have the aspect of performance that I love so much within the podcast. I was still using a skill set that I loved so much, and now I'm living a life that was better than the one that I could have imagined doing acting. So I think when you look at your limitations, it allows you to pivot in a way that serves you even better. So I think it's healthy to look at that.
You are very careful to say that it's a mistake if we think about the matter of starting over, starting from scratch, as kind of a worst-case scenario. And you are really telling us that starting over, beginning again, jettisoning what you are doing in favor of something entirely different, that is something to embrace as a really exciting possibility and not something to dread or to be embarrassed about.
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes when you hit rock bottom, it feels like it's worst-case scenario, but it allows for you to shake up other things that maybe you would have never addressed. So, for example, if you're cruising along and things are going well and then your partner just leaves you out of the blue, it's horrible, but it then allows you to think, wait a minute, okay, well, now that this has changed, what other things in my life am I not happy with? This is my opportunity to kind of I can really shake things up and turn everything around. You know, I can. I don't have to be living this way. I don't have to continue on with just this heartbreak and this loss. You know, I've done it twice where I had a heartbreak and it caused me to move to Paris for a year. And, you know, it really expanded my horizons because I thought if something's going to change, I'm going to lean into that change and I'm going to cause even more change for myself because while I'm at it, why not go all out, you know?
I love the way in which you spend some time talking about the importance of us understanding our purpose and embracing our sense of purpose, the sense of being actually useful. And I think it's really great that that you are using as sort of an ordinary and utilitarian a term as that. I mean, obviously, you see great significance, deep meaning in just that, you know, rather mundane sounding idea of being useful in one's life.
Yes, 100%, because I look at purpose as, even though it has to be fulfilling for the individual, it has to also be connected with something else or with nature or with animals, with humans. It's where you are being useful, because when you feel useful, that's when you feel, in a sense, validated, you feel appreciated, you feel like you are a part of something greater than you. In the community, if you look at centenarians that, you know, are living independently, they are still working on their purpose. They're still useful within the community. You look at old people who degenerate a lot faster, and they're the ones that have been isolated from the community and they've retired and they don't really have a purpose every day. So to create longevity and to create, you know, brain health, you want to always think, how can I do something that still serves me? I don't have to be a martyr. I want it to serve me. I want to feel fulfilled, but that I can contribute in some way to something outside of me.
Mm. I do want to make sure that we talk for a moment about this notion that you raise in your book, How to Chase Change, about having a positive relationship with yourself. And you see that as the foundation for all relationships that we end up having with other people. Explain why you are embracing that notion of having a relationship with yourself. Because, of course, it's far more often for us to think about relationships only in terms of our relationship with somebody else.
That's right. Yeah. So the way you want to look at it is the relationship you have with yourself sets the standard. That's kind of where the bar is set. If you're someone that has a really poor relationship with yourself, you don't like to sit with your own thoughts, you avoid ever being alone, you never allow yourself to get bored because you don't like, you know, what's going on in your default mode network in your brain. And if you have negative self-talk, of course, on top of that, you are more likely to accept relationships that are unkind, or, you know, where the power dynamic is shifted to the other person, or where it's just straight up unhealthy. Because the bar is set so low, if you increase, you know, if you really work on your relationship with yourself and you become, you know, a person that you have your own back, you can rely on yourself, you can entertain yourself when you're alone, then you think, well, my life is pretty good on my own. I've created a standard for what my life is like. I'm only going to accept relationships and friendships that exceed that standard, because if the alternative is me being alone and really enjoying my company, why would I enter a relationship that's worse than that? That just wouldn't make sense. The only time you do is when you struggle to be in your own company. And I know that from firsthand experience, being in unhealthy relationships and the work I had to do after that, because I realized I was accepting this, but I didn't want to be alone either.
Hmm. You raise in your book this intriguing notion that when we have a strong, healthy relationship with ourselves, that it can be something of an insurance policy. A really interesting turn of phrase.
Yes.
Can you quickly just explain what you're talking about there?
Yeah, definitely. So when you have that really strong relationship with yourself, it's so much easier to set boundaries, to teach people how to treat you. You hold the cards, because you're able to say, if this isn't working, I can actually walk away. You never want to be in a position, whether it's friendships or whether it's romantically, where you feel that you have to stay because you don't have any other option. Your other option is yourself having your own back and knowing that you're resilient and you can create other friendships and other connections outside of this unhealthy one that you're involved in. So if you look at that as your insurance policy. You're saying, I never, ever, ever again have to be in a position where I'm being treated this way, where I have to accept, you know, how people are talking to me in a way that I don't like, where I have to accept this, you know, behavior from somebody else, because I know that I can remove myself. I'm confident enough that I can do that, and I'm not going to, you know, crumble. I will be able to support myself. So that's what I mean about that insurance policy. You'll feel a lot more confident to say no, to walk away, to put boundaries in place, to really protect yourself.
Mm. A last quick question. I know it's time to go. For people who have encountered you in your wonderful, fascinating podcast, you sound just a little bit different in this audiobook from Simon & Schuster, How to Chase Change. You have gone from explicit language to non-explicit language in this audiobook. I'm just curious what that experience was like for you to be expressing yourself and your ideas in a little bit different fashion.
Yeah, it was quite an interesting experience, because the podcast is very free-flowing and I speak my mind and it, you know, and I go on tangents and it all rolls off the tongue, whereas this book, you know, it's very concise. I need to, you know, really narrow it down to exactly what I want to say in these 10 minutes, which is, you know, my episodes go for about 50 minutes. So it was actually a great exercise for me to try something different and not only not go off on a tangent, but also not be swearing, not be saying all these things. So, yeah, it was really great. I really enjoy the two kind of sides of, like, the audiobook versus the podcast. It's similar but different enough.
Right. Well, we certainly have your unmistakable voice and, of course, your tremendous expertise as a neuroscientist, Alexis Fernandez-Preixa, and your new book, an audiobook from Simon & Schuster, is How to Chase Change, 30 Days to Master Your Mindset. Thank you for giving the world this fascinating book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. It was great to speak with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Take care. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's program features an interview that was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2008. And indeed, I am honored now for the next few minutes to be speaking with Jonathan Kozal, who is the author of a number of different books, including now a book called Letters to a Young Teacher, published by Crown, in which we can read some of the letters which he wrote to a young teacher who contacted him, someone he calls in the pages of this book Francesca. That is not her name, and she remains an anonymous figure, but the catalyst for some very, very helpful letters that Jonathan Kozal has written for the young teacher just starting out in this paramountly important vocation. Jonathan Kozal, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks very much, and I'm glad you said what you did about my new book. The whole point of Letters to a Young Teacher is to present a kind of tribute, but also an invitation to what I believe to be admittedly very difficult, but still beautiful profession. I think teaching children in our public schools, and especially teaching young children, is one of the best ways a human being could spend their life. And I began as a teacher myself, teaching little kids in inner city schools, all black schools, and now this young teacher, this wonderful young teacher, wrote to me, and she was teaching also at an all-black school in Boston, my hometown, in a neighborhood not far from where I'd started out 40 years before. So she said, would you come and visit my class? Lots of teachers asked me to do that, and I did. And, of course, as soon as I arrived, she put me to work, because teachers... I love it the way teachers knock me off my pedestal. You know, I don't like to be treated as a author or some kind of expert. They say, don't just stand there. do something.
Yeah,
help,
grab those paints or whatever.
Help my kids. Help
yeah.
my kids.
In fact,
and then,
you...
and then when I did it wrong, actually, I made first thing she asked me to do, I messed it up. She scolded me in front of the children. I love that. She's 24 years old, and she said, Mr. Jonathan, since the kids couldn't pronounce Kozol, my last name, she said, Mr. Jonathan did not pay attention. He is not behaving like a grown-up. What should we do to punish him? And the kids voted I needed a timeout. I love little kids. And she's one of these glowing souls that, you know, the kind of teacher little kids will remember their whole lives. Just flooded her room with poetry and wonderful poetry. Not, you know, lots of African-American poetry, but also she was immersed in great literature herself. So she was reading these little first graders poetry by William Butler Yeats, and but you'd come in the room and it'd be flooded with music like Brahms and Rachmaninoff, and she absolutely refused to drill her children for examinations, for tests. She hated this law, No Child Left Behind. She refused to impose that kind of drill and kill routine to get the kids ready for their tests. And despite that, almost all her kids did very well in their exams, which is a tribute, I think, to her enormous creativity, because she worked hard. She just would not, she refused to impose a kind of proto-military regime on these kids, which is very, very common now in inner-city schools.
She was, of course, coming to you for advice, although it sounds like she was a very gifted teacher with a lot of wonderful instincts. And one of your most central points of advice for her and other young teachers is the idea of establishing chemistry between yourself and the student, as opposed to the often advised protocol of starting out tough, sticking to the curriculum, that sort of thing. You suggest instead entrapping them first in fascination. I love the way you put that.
Absolutely. I think especially with young kids in anywhere from kindergarten to fourth grade, it's very, very important to convince them right from the start that learning is exciting, that it's joyful, mysterious, exhilarating experience. And she conveyed that to them. She had this sense of jubilation in her. She was enormously happy to be in the company of children. And people who aren't shouldn't teach school, I don't think. Fortunately, there are thousands like her nowadays, but she, there's a special, I talk about the chemistry that evolves, a kind of mystical chemistry of trust and love that evolves between a good teacher and her students. And it's a very beautiful thing to see, especially in those early grades when they come to you in September, they're little strangers. In June, you cry because you don't want to say goodbye to them. And I tell teachers that chemistry is more important than anything else. Mm. Don't let any of these tough testing demands that are coming down from Washington interfere with that. Don't let anything ruin that chemistry. If you lose that, you lose everything.
As you describe this in various chapters, the unfolding of this relationship, this chemistry, I think one of the most telling moments is when you talk of the importance of those small little moments when a young child might reveal to a teacher some sort of secret. You say some children who reveal their secrets to us in these hesitant and bashful ways seem to feel empowered later to reveal themselves in more outgoing ways as they begin to gain the literary skills to write in classroom journals, for instance, or maybe make their first attempts at poetry. I mean, I think that's such an important bit of advice, because that's the sort of thing, the importance of which might not maybe be immediately apparent to a young teacher.
That's right. And one reason is that young teachers nowadays, again, I don't like to harp on this repeatedly, but the law No Child Left Behind has had a very damaging effect in this respect. The law requires that teachers stick to a very tight timetable. They are, and I might say, the whole idea of the law is that teachers need to be held accountable for their success. And I don't know any teacher who's afraid to be held accountable, but they want to be held accountable for the right things. And what happens in many of these inner city schools in Milwaukee, for example, in Chicago, in New York, is that because the demands that the state requires, the state standards, as they're called, which are enforced at the national level by the federal law, No Child Left Behind, there's very tight timing in the classroom. You've got to deliver this specific skill at 9:35 in the morning. And what happens is that, little kids are determined to subvert our lesson plans because they want to tell us something interesting that happened to them that comes right out of their heart. So little boy raises his hand and says, "Teacher, my grandma died yesterday, and he wants to tell her about this." And she feels, Francesca would listen, but many teachers feel, "I can't listen to this, because if some supervisor comes around and checks on my classroom, I won't be on the required skill for that moment, that minute of the day." And so she has to cut him off. If she listens, you'll often find that at the end of those delectable run-on sentences at which little children are so good, there's a real piece of hidden treasure where that child reveals something about himself. Let's say it's a little boy, something deep and important to his soul. And good teachers seize upon that moment as a key to unlock motivation in the child. But in too many of these inner city schools now, the teacher's afraid to do that. She has to cut him off. And so she never finds that secret in his soul. I was strongly influenced, this may surprise many of your listeners, I was strongly influenced by a man I believe to be probably the best educator of young children of the past 50 years in the United States. And this was not some academic person. This was Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, who came with me up to the South Bronx, where several of my books take place in New York City, to meet the children I was writing about. And he always said to me, "Listen to these children. Listen to them. Don't rush them. Give them a chance so they can reveal themselves to you."
I like how you say about Mr. Rogers, you say Mr. Rogers' legacy is viewed as soft and too impressionistic in an age when very hard and measurable outcomes have been stringently demanded by the overseers of public education, whose certitude about the practices that they enforce seems nearly absolute. You are really fervently hoping that, at least to some extent, we can return more to the view that people like Fred Rogers have about what is most important in education.
Absolutely, and my whole book, Letters to Young Children, is dedicated to that ideal, but I'm also fighting politically. I've spent a great deal of the past summer in Washington talking with the members of the Senate and the House who are going to decide in the next few months whether to repeal this federal law or to continue it or to revise it dramatically. And as a matter of fact, a few weeks from now, I'm going to meet with probably the most influential member of the Senate who chairs the Education Committee, and that's Senator Ted Kennedy. We have a date set in which I want to convince him that Senate and House absolutely we need to reduce the testing mania. They ought to reduce it drastically, and instead of putting all the pressure on a one-time examination in order to measure whether a child is learning or whether a school or teacher is any good, they ought to look at more important things, such as how many children are in that classroom? Are we giving these poor kids the same wonderful small class size of 17 or 18 children that you'd see in the rich suburbs? Or are we packing 30, 35 kids into each room? How many of these kids are getting preschool? Or, because we know the affluent typically give their children 2 or 3 years of wonderful preschool, whereas the inner city kids get almost nothing. Unless you give universal preschool to these poor kids, then when you test them on exams a few years later, you're testing rich kids on twice as much education as the poor children have received. So I'm also actually demanding that Senator Kennedy write into this law, No Child Left Behind, a provision that that states have to guarantee at least 2 years of rich developmental preschool to all low-income children before they can give them the standardized exam.
I want to mention that your book focuses on a number of specific issues, which unfortunately we have no time to talk about today, but things like focus on diversity and the state of high schools and middle schools and so on, all kinds of interesting information. I actually want to close with something else, though, something in which you celebrate the attitude and perspective of this young teacher with whom you corresponded.
Oh, yes.
You say, one of the reasons why I have found our conversations and our correspondence so refreshing, this is again speaking to Francesca, is that you enjoy so much the small realities and daily misadventures, even the wet and messy ones,
yeah,
that take place in the classroom with your children. And those are probably very, very important words of reassurance and encouragement, that teachers not sweep those kind of moments aside, but embrace them as being central sometimes to the whole experience of teachers and children.
Yeah, she once said to me, when one of her children peed or something like that in his pants, because he's a little baby, she said, "6-year-olds are leaky little people." And the way she said that showed that she loved them completely. And I say to teachers, you're in a tough time right now. It's a tough era where people are threatening your profession. There's enormous political contempt for teachers. I hear it in Washington all the time. And there's a strong movement, the voucher movement, to try to basically dismantle public education and throw away this great legacy that we've been given as Americans. But I say to teachers, despite all of that, hold up the sense of delight and joy in being a teacher. And no matter what's going on the political front, bring your own beautiful personality into that classroom. Flood that classroom with all the treasures of poetry and everything that you've loved in your own life. And don't let anybody take that away from you. That's because if teachers aren't happy in the classroom, they're not going to be good teachers, and they're going to quit. If we want to keep them, we've got to enable them to enjoy that same sense of jubilation that I described throughout this book.
The book, again, is called Letters to a Young Teacher, published by Crown. Jonathan Kozal, I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show, and very best wishes to you.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Our third and final interview on today's program is an interview that actually was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2023.
Well, it's not too often that we get to talk on the morning show about one of my favorite things, science fiction. And I'm very honored to have with me on the morning show for a few minutes a much-honored science fiction writer, author, Ben Bova, 6 times the winner of science fiction's top award, the Hugo Award, and the author of all kinds of works of what he likes to call science fact and fiction. And his most...
I'm a man of simple taste.
And his most recent work is a novel called Saturn. And in a sense, it's part of a series in which author Ben Bova has taken us out into the solar system one world at a time. And we will talk a few minutes about this particular work and about his work as a science fiction writer. And Ben Bova, we welcome you to the morning show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Greg, for inviting me.
I have to say that not long ago, I had the real pleasure of speaking with the son of the author of the Dune works.
Oh, Brian Herbert.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He has written a biography of his father called Dreamer of Dune. And I only mention it because in the midst of our really interesting conversation, we talked a little bit about what drew his father to science fiction. And I wish I had the book in front of me, but he talks about how his father found that in the realm of science fiction, it was like all bets were off or all constraints were off, and the only limits were one's own imagination. I'd like to sort of pose the same question to you, if I may. What is it that draws you as a writer to the realm of science fiction versus other literary genres?
Well, it's the only literary genre where you can write about what's really moving ourselves and our society, about the forces of science and technology and their interaction with government. That's what's shaping our lives. That's what's shaping our world. And the rest of literature ignores this.
Hmm. Tell us about your initial encounters with science fiction. Are you what we would imagine, someone who enjoyed it growing up, or did you come to science fiction only later?
I never knew it was called science fiction. I just thought it was stories about the future and about new technological and scientific breakthroughs. When I started writing as a teenager, I was writing about the things that interested me. There were some dreamers out there talking about possibly sending rockets to the moon. That fascinated me. So I began to write about that and indeed wound up working on one of those rocket programs, the first American satellite program, Vanguard. So I've been writing about what I know.
What kind of science fiction has been influential on you?
Well, mostly what we call in the trade hard science fiction, the kinds of things that Isaac Asimov and Robert Heinlein wrote, and Frank Herbert, as a matter of fact. It gives you an opportunity to look at how these terrific forces of science and technology affect our lives. And although many writers try to show that they're problems and they're dangerous, what I'm doing is showing how we can use science and technology to make our lives better.
Hmm. One of the things that is interesting about a novel like this, like Saturn, is you give us a scenario in which a fairly sizable group of Earthlings are being transported to Saturn to settle there. And there's a couple of different choices. I suppose there's a limitless number of choices that a writer can make. They can imagine that in a very fanciful sort of way, or they can try to imagine that in the way that it might really happen. In a sense, try to give us a peek into what they would foresee as a likely future. Where would you say you fall in that continuum as you set works in the future?
I think that's really for the critics to say, but I'm trying to write very realistic novels. I'm writing about real people in new and different situations. I think of my novels as historical novels that haven't happened yet. And I try to make them as accurate as possibly can, show what these worlds will be like and how these different worlds will pose challenges and opportunities for people.
Hmm.
And the people will still be very human. They'll still have their loves and hates, their desires and their fears. And in fact, my novel Saturn is mainly about these 10,000 people who are literally exiled from Earth and how they form their own government, how they get along together, how they adjust to the fact that they're going to be living off the Earth for the rest of their lives.
That is an interesting choice in and of itself, the idea of exiles from the planet Earth. What led you to make that particular choice?
Oh, just looking back into history and seeing when you have a repressive government, they either kill the free thinkers or get rid of them one way or another. A nation like Australia was settled by political exile, and we have this habitat I've built in the novel Saturn, which is several miles long, completely Earth-like inside. It's something of a paradise physically, but it's never going to be Earth.
Is this the Goddard?
Yes.
Yes.
They named it Goddard. I named it that after the American rocket pioneer, Robert Goddard.
Right. I was struck by that. But also interested in that you use this term habitat. I mean,
yes.
This is something that is this what transports them?
Yes. Think of a large flying stovepipe, you know, sealed off on both ends, several miles long, more than a mile across, and slowly rotating along its long axis so that inside you have a feeling of earthly gravity. And the inside is landscape. It's got hills and trees and grass, and little villages here and there, streams, lakes. So it's really quite beautiful and quite a lovely place to be as long as you're going to be exiled. As some characters tell others in the novel, you know, there are worse places that you could be.
Hmm. Choice you make, of course, which is a certainly a laudable one, is that you populate this novel, and I'm thinking your others as well, with very real people, often rough around the edges and not always heroic. So this is not like what Star Trek was called, the Captain Horatio Hornblower in space scenario. This is not that at all.
No, this is more like you and I get stuck in this joint and we have to make the best of it.
Tell us about the planet Saturn. One of the things that that you do such a good job of in this novel, I think, is describing this world and its beauty and the sense of mystery which really still surrounds it.
Well, thank you. Saturn is the second largest planet in the solar system. It's a little bit smaller than Jupiter. But it's got this enormous system of rings, these big, bright, beautiful rings, that even the earliest astronomers who used telescopes saw them and puzzled over them. Why are they there? What are they? And we know now that the rings are actually composed of chunks of ice, water ice, a very valuable commodity if you're living in space. And the real question is, why does Saturn have these beautiful rings and the other planets don't? Jupiter and Uranus and Neptune all have ring systems, but they're very small, faint, crumbly, dark rings. Saturn has these big, beautiful, glowing rings, and apparently something is keeping them there, renewing them as they fall into the planet. And that's one of the questions that we try to look at in the novel.
Among the many interesting ideas or themes which are drawn through this novel, there are a couple of them that are very interesting. One of them is that one of your major characters is put into, I guess, what sort of amounts to deep freeze for many, many years. I think because of a very, very serious illness. Is it cancer?
Yes,
or something
yes,
like that?
Yes, she was dying of cancer. Her sister had her declared clinically dead. In fact, her sister gave her the lethal injection.
Hmm.
And then they froze her in liquid nitrogen for many years. Now she's revived. She's retrained. Been taught to speak again and toilet trained and all that. And she's got the body of a 30-year-old woman, but her mind is still sort of like a teenager's. And that's a dangerous combination.
Well, and it's a wonderful combination for you as a writer because
sure.
you can create a character that is rich and complicated in a way that we really haven't exactly seen before.
Holly is also pretty feisty. She goes out on this jaunt to Saturn on her own. She's found a new life and she wants to live it her own way. Much to her sister's disappointment. Her sister has become a very wealthy and powerful woman back living on the moon, and her sister's very disappointed that Holly has decided to go off and live her own way.
I am intrigued by the fact that in your book you spend a fair amount of time talking about the largest moon of Saturn, which I think for many years was thought to be the largest moon in the solar system. I think it eventually was figured out to be maybe the second largest or so, but it's that intriguing body known as Titan.
Yes.
We know some things about Titan which make it a very, very interesting place.
Yeah, Titan is sort of the Los Angeles of the solar system. It's got a thick atmosphere that's filled with hydrocarbon particles, and it's always smoggy. It's very difficult to see the surface of Titan because the atmosphere is so full of smog. Now, that kind of an atmosphere has lots of organic chemicals in it, the stuff of life. And the question is there life on Titan? In my novel, the scientists have found with their preliminary probe that there are life forms on the surface of Titan. They want to investigate them, but they don't want any people going to Titan for a long, long time because they're afraid human beings will contaminate the life forms there. Meanwhile, one of the guys on the habitat going out there is a stuntman. He makes a living out of doing impossible stunts like climbing the tallest mountain in the solar system on Mars or surfing the clouds of Jupiter. Now he wants to be the first human being to go to the surface of Titan, and a scientist will chop his legs off if he tries it. So we get some conflict there and some humorous moments, too.
Well, it's certainly a novel that's just full of all kinds of thought-provoking, provocative ideas, and it makes us think about something that is so exciting and yet at the same time frightening in some ways.
Don't be scared.
But, I mean, it's the prospect of leaving this planet, and how are we going to do that? When are we going to do that? And are we going to do it in ways that are wise and ultimately beneficial?
Well, that's in a democracy, that's really up to us. We have a couple of people living in orbit right now aboard the International Space Station. We have many people on Earth who want to move into space. In my novels, and Saturn is part of a series that's been titled The Grand Tour of the Solar System, in these novels I postulate the idea that the Earth is hit by a very sudden and very violent greenhouse warming, and coastal cities are flooded out, the electrical power grid is shorted out, tens of millions of people are out of their homes, out of work, out of hope. So we've got a catastrophic situation on Earth, and this forces people to move into space to develop the resources of energy and the raw materials that will be used to rebuild the Earth. The people going to Saturn are largely free thinkers. They don't like to go along with the government. The governments of Earth are pretty repressive, and their way of getting rid of original thinkers is to get rid of them, put them in a habitat, and send them off a billion miles away.
The book is Saturn, and the author, Ben Bova, and the book is published by Tor. Ben Bova, a real pleasure and honor speaking with you today on The Morning Show, and I hope we get to talk again as you continue writing these marvelous books. Thank you so much for your time.
This interview was actually recorded back in 2003. Ben Bova ended up having a career as a writer for some 60 years, six times a winner of the Hugo Award, the author ultimately of 124 books. Ben Bova sadly died back in 2020 at the age of 88 from COVID-related pneumonia. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'll be speaking with Dr. Art Sear, paying his first visit to us in 2025. He'll be reflecting on a number of issues and concerns, including, of course, the inauguration of President Donald Trump to a second term. And on Friday's morning show, we'll be welcoming the Poets Laureate of both Kenosha and Racine to the morning show. Today's going to be cloudy and windy, more seasonal temperatures, a 70% chance of light snow later this morning, possibly an inch of accumulation. Today's high 22 degrees. Perhaps another inch of snow overnight with a low of 13. Sunny tomorrow with a high of 23. Sunshine expected to continue on Friday as well. Daytime highs in the low 20s. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.